Part 4, Engagement. I wonder if there is something about living on an island that gives people special qualities and special needs. Perhaps it produces a sort of compensatory anti-provincialism, a broadening of horizons and an education of the heart toward receptivity to those outside. If so, Swami Kanananda was an ideal island man. Before coming to the West, he had carried out, with significant success, assignments for the order on Sri Lanka and then on Mauritius. Gradually, the talent for reflecting and expressing the spiritual needs of the people of England must have grown in him. For although Swami did not have, by comparison with some monks in other large Western cities, a sizable following, he was remarkably successful with those attracted by his work and thought, both in helping to develop their spiritual faculties and in seeing that they had developed a lifelong commitment to sadhana. His Indian students we have already taken note of. It is time to mention what other sorts of persons came into his orbit and the means and methods he used in serving them. Prominent in the first issues of the journal are the names of the writers Sir John Stuart Wallace and Kenneth Walker. Early friends, they helped Swami in editorial, business, and public relations matters, both directly and through their own contacts. It was before my time, but well remembered that Mr. Walker, a surgeon, teacher, and philosopher, had been of outstanding help and usefulness to Swami and to Vedanta in Britain. Most of the devotees came from ordinary walks of life, middle and lower middle income people. They were secretaries, teachers, civil servants, accountants, and housewives. On the board of management of the center were, among others, two physicians, a professor, and a man who ran a bicycle shop. Geoffrey Watkins, of London's famous bookshop, was a trustee whom it was often necessary to consult, and unfailingly a friend to all of us. One of Swami's most interesting and fruitful connections was with an author who was also a housewife, writing plays for the BBC and articles for the magazine, making retreats from time to time at Muswell Hill while running her home in the west of England. I met the political and academic figure Lord Soper, Marcus Braybrooke, an ecumenically inspired clergyman, and the classicist Norman Marlowe, who taught at Manchester University. During this period, I pondered on why a thinker like Swami Vivekananda, so much lionized in his own day, whose teachings had received both publicity and appreciation at the time he worked in England, should seemingly have been buried in the ensuing 70 years, at least so far as penetrating into British thought and society is concerned. I do not feel I have all the answers as yet, but I have realized it is not merely a British phenomenon, it has happened worldwide, and even in India itself to some extent. The times have changed. One recalls the work of Meister Eckhart and of many others, lost and rediscovered. Some of Swami Kanananda's Occidental students and friends were not British, but simply resident in England, having come, like so many Londoners, from the continent and contributing to the cosmopolitan complexion of the life of the great city. Some would fly in from Europe to see him. Others would invite him to visit them. Swami made in this way a total of 8 trips abroad, which included a remarkable meeting in Athens attended by 1,000 people, and a visit to C.G. Jung in Zurich in 1952. Swami told us on several occasions about this visit. The superconscious state had been their topic of discussion in an atmosphere of friendly exchange. Jung was looking for an authoritative and rational explanation of it. Had been, it seems, for years, and Swami Kalananda offered the remark that it transcended the distinctions of knower, known, and knowledge. The state being indescribable, even for one who has experienced it, Swami said it was not surprising that Dr. Jung's requirements of definition had been difficult to satisfy. Jung then asked the question, so difficult for Westerners to forego, what does it gain one? What gain is there from samadhi? It gives supreme peace and light, was Swami's reply. But is it worth it? Jung suggested with a slight smile. The remainder of this conversation is not recorded, but the very asking of such a question belies that enlightenment we seem to see in some of Jung's published work. Few could imagine Swami's facility and expertise in business and financial matters. It seemed so improbable. But the members of the board spoke of his quick grasp of the issues and a store of administrative acumen beneath his deceptive surface of almost naive simplicity. There was a board member who, retired from business, had served Swami many years as a kind of confessor figure, to whom he could confide much and whose opinion was asked and valued. This man occupied that advisory role for the center as long as he lived, which was not for long after the Swami's passing. Though he had on a number of occasions to trim Swami Kalananda's designs to a more practical cut, he nevertheless had a high opinion of the Swami's judgment in everything. As Sri Ramakrishna used to say, one who can measure salt can also measure sugar. And as I remarked at the beginning of these memoirs, common to all the monks of the order well known to me was a large measure of common sense with which their idealism was usually seasoned. Swami kept everybody busy, visitors and ashramites alike. Some employment would be found, a devotee described it, in the kitchen, the garden, the mail order books department, in the office, typing letters and articles, and especially in preparation for festivals, for all your known talents and those you never knew you had. Swami had a quaint way of dealing with complaints about others. If anyone came to him in high dudgeon over the shortcomings of a fellow worker, or about how irritated one felt by the slights or slurs of different persons, he would spread a wide grin, cock his head a bit on one side and say, yes, people are like that. Cluck his tongue and then laugh. It was as much as to say, you are right, to be sure, but then what can we do about it? It was Sri Ramakrishna's endure, endure, endure. Not preached, but shared. Classic was the description given by our playwright in the memorial edition of Vedanta for East and West, number 116. of the precise balances in Swami Kalananda's teaching method. Quote, to those of us whose work reached and might influence the general public outside the center, he taught the duty of listening to the Ishta within, rather than to comment and criticism from outside. And he himself refused, I found in my own case, to interfere or to make suggestions. His method here was always to give help indirectly by what one learned simply from being with him, though he always answered direct questions patiently and in great detail. Although he gave his blessing to the work and watched over it with concern and attention, he always taught me to turn to the Ishta as the ultimate guide. The work must come from within. Had I not known him, I should never have believed it possible for strong authority and the giving of freedom to be so perfectly blended in one and the same person. End of quote. I, from my own experience and recollection, can heartily endorse her statement. Swami used different means to effect his ends. He often took great pains, using even harsh measures, to help one see one's weaknesses. But the evidence of his utter detachment in the midst of all his guruship was the fact that his attitude, mood, expression, and tone of voice could change radically towards several different persons in succession. Someone said she saw him change mood 3 times on the way upstairs to match the mood of the 3 persons he met on the way. He seemed to catch the vibrational state, so to speak, of a person, as if he were like a mirror held up to each. Meeting yourself that way, so to speak, gave you a certain power of self-monitoring. Actually, I said it all when I spoke of his magic. Disciples testify to his speaking of events apart from his sense knowledge, in other times and places, and of how he warded off dangers for them and averted looming disasters, without impinging on their freedom to make mistakes if they were bent on it. Someone, doubting these powers, asked him point blank, Swamiji, is it true that you can read our thoughts? If so, would you answer this question I am asking now? And he at once answered it aloud. He told another that he read thoughts only when it helped someone, or when he felt it was the right moment. These capacities made Swami a very unusual monk, but what I treasure more, now that the years have gone by, are the great paradoxes, mystery and simplicity, scholarship and innocence, authority and humility, fearlessness and sweetness. He didn't lead, said a seasoned disciple. He pushed. True, and yet in other cases, people felt that he neither led nor pushed, but simply was. Just being with him, even if he was talking about the proper way to cook rice, carried them somehow toward the chosen aspect of deity, providing the link which was so difficult to establish for oneself. Nor did he need to be present to do this. As I hinted at the beginning of the chapter, he appears to have possessed a power of spiritual psychokinesis.